Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening and welcome to the Tattered Cover. I just want to thank you all for coming tonight, and also always thank you for your support of Tattered Cover and all the other independent bookstores around the country. We're very excited tonight to have best-selling author Anne Lamott here with her latest book, co-written with her son, Sam Lamott, Some Assembly Required, a journal of my son's first son. I was curious how many of you here tonight read Operating Instructions. And it's like a book you'll never forget, right? It just stays with you. And it's a book you can read over and over again. And I was so excited when this book came out, like I know a lot of you were too. I remember where I was reading operating instructions when I had my kids, and crying and laughing. And then I just got back from the mountains and being with my two first grandchildren that are 2 and 6 months. And it just didn't go for 3 nights with their parents, you know, my son and his wife. And I thought, oh, it's going to be so wonderful. We'll watch movies at night. I'll play with the kids. And it was like, it just didn't go like that. And I got back to my desk this afternoon. I thought, you know, I bet Anne Lamott has something since it's kind of the first year. I bet if I hit the middle of the book, that would be 6 months. Maybe there'll be something about a 6-month-old grandson. And there is. And it's Valentine's Day. And her son and the mother of her grandson come to stay. And she's going to give them this wonderful Valentine's Day and let them go to the movies and babysit. And, you know, it just didn't go quite like you imagine it to. And really, I read it and I was like, oh, good. It's, remember, you're just a grandma, you know. Anne Lamott, as many of you know, is the author of the New York Times bestsellers Grace Eventually, Plan B, Traveling Mercies, and Operating Instructions, as well as 2 other books of nonfiction and 7 novels, including Imperfect Birds, Rosie, Crooked Little Heart, and we have all of those books over there. She is a past recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship, an inductee to the California Hall of Fame, a former columnist for Salon, and she lives in Northern California. Her son, who co-wrote the book, Sam Lamott, who was very busy and couldn't be here tonight, is currently studying industrial design, and he lives in San Francisco. Please help me welcome Anne Lamott.
So I have a new life, which is twittering. And Sam said I had to do it for this book tour. And I also had to do Facebook. And I can kind of do Facebook like a semi-mature citizen, because I just don't, it doesn't work for me. I haven't hooked in. I don't care that much. And and with Twitter, I am so strung out. And so I wanted to ask you all who Twitter, if you could Twitter my friend, the great, wonderful novelist, Carolyn Leavitt. It's just exactly like it sounds. So you can actually get your phones out now if you want. And Twitter Carolyn Leavitt, Caroline, and tell her how incredible I look in the green scarf she knit me. Okay? So let's just take care of business. Now, do you know how to use the camera? I'm going to move over. I'll pretend to be reading.
Okay.
thank you. Oh, that's so cute. Okay. I'm not very photogenic, so I'm just so pleased if I get a good picture. But now I have to send it because I don't really know how to save pictures very effectively. So I'll send it both to myself. This is kind of a different kind of reading, huh? And then I take pictures of myself. Caroline Levitt. Oh, I don't know where she's at. I'll just send it to myself. I can't remember her address right now. She's a wonderful writer. If you don't know her, you should find out about her. Now, I have a Twitter question. Can you send pictures by Twitter?
Yes.
Now, how do you do that? We'll talk. Somebody afterwards come up, okay? Because I really want to send pictures of myself out on Twitter. I'm just completely out of control. I mean, I'm so not a social media person. I can't do anything. I can hardly work a toaster. And I love me some Twitter. So, well, Sam's been on tour with me till Sunday. So he was on the East Coast, New York and Boston and D.C. and Atlanta. And that was great. You know, he's 22 and a half now. It's funny because people's first question is always, how's Sam? So it was funny to do this reading where this tall, handsome, slightly shy guy was standing around with me. And, you know, it doesn't matter what age they are. You're just always an embarrassment to your children. So Sam's thing with me was looking at his watch and then rolling his eyes because I always go on too long. So... But it was very sweet and very, really fun. And I cried in Chicago because in St. Louis, he went on to, he went home. He's got a 2.5-year-old. And I came to Chicago and I didn't know I would care. You know, it was hard. It's kind of hard to travel with somebody. And but still, I just wept in Chicago. I had a meltdown. So anyway, I just want to also mention for the record, this is being podcast. And I so don't know what that even means. I don't think it has to do with Twitter, so I don't care. But it's being podcast for worldwide distribution from the great, in fact, the legendary Tattered Cover in Denver, Colorado. So, wait 1 second. So, is it 7:30? Okay, sorry, I have like 40 minutes. I just want to, well, I'll Simonize our watches, as the Three Stooges used to say. This is a book that is a sequel to Operating Instructions, which I didn't plan to write. It didn't really have the intention to write. And my editor asked if I would write a sequel once Jax was born. And I said I thought it would be exploitive. And he said, not if you don't exploit anyone. So I asked Sam, because I didn't really want to do it alone. And I thought, me just doing it was kind of beating a dead horse. And I thought, with the voice of a really young dad, he was 19 when he had his son, it's a voice that you don't have enough opportunity to hear. And so he was thrilled. If you read the preface, you'll see, oh, this is an unsigned book, which just makes me too nervous for words. So I'll sign it. I know we could take a picture of me signing my book, and then we could tweet it. So if you read the preface, Sam was really excited because with Operating Instructions, he felt, as when he started reading it at probably 11 or so, and he just felt that it was such a direct connection from my heart to his, that that's really what the book was about, which it was. And he said, I really wanted Jax to have one of his own. So I kept a journal very steadily in my adorable OCD way, you know, in my perfect girl, my entire life kind of way. And then there was Sam, who I remember at 15, if any of you have had teenagers, you know what trying to get them to do their homework is like. It's just a nightmare. It's just, you know, I had to do bribes and threats and money had to change hands. And that's what it was like writing this book. Because sometimes he'd have something and he'd know that he had tapped into something really lovely. And he would, how many people tweeted Caroline Leavitt? Let me see a show of hands. Oh, it's such a disappointment. But thank you. Thank you. Three. Okay, but you'll have time afterwards. Sometimes he'd call and he'd say, you know, the one thing that you did with me that I swore I'd never do with my kid, what, honey, was the worrying. And he said, I just swore I'd never be like you. And that, and then the baby would be 4 days old, and Sam would have a, or Jax, the baby would have a fleecy blanket called the Mr. Bear blanket, because it had this tiny little fuzzy Mr. Bear head in the corner. And Sam would become obsessed about how the bear head could trap carbon monoxide or whatever, carbon dioxide, whichever it is, and smother Jax. And he said, I can't believe it. And I always said, you know, the last complacent breath you draw is when, if you want to be pregnant, you discover you're pregnant. And then I said, what was the best thing? What did you love? He said, what I loved was you spent so much time on the floor with me. So advice to the little ones, that's what they remember, is that you didn't just set them up with Legos and crayons. You did Legos and crayons with them. So that's what it was like. We did it for a year, just like operating instructions. It ends on the baby's first year. And there's an interview. You don't even have to buy the magazine. There's two I like, two pieces. One is in More, and that was the one I was going to mention. It's where Sam and I interview each other. And if you're the parents of teenagers, I really think there's useful material in there about how what the biggest gift the parents can give the teenager is to get help for their own problems. You know, and not think that they should be the solution to the kids' problems, and to stop thinking that what they want for their kids' future has nothing to do with what is going to happen or B, the right thing to happen. And so that's the one I love most and More, but no one reads More. And then, but I loved my editor there. So I want to put in a good word for her. And then the one at Oprah, where it was just awful, awful experience getting this one published. I've written a number of pieces, and it was one of those times where I thought, oh, if you get an Oprah, you'll just sell a million copies. And to do it took so much out of me, that not because of the piece, which is on spiritual deliciousness, because the art, you know, they always have a topic, and this was deliciousness. And so I said, I thought spiritual, how do you come to know what is truly delicious to you on your deepest interior level, instead of what everybody tells you you love, or what you know you should love, or what you really hope you grow to love, or what your partner really loves and you said you did too. So I think you would like that. And God, that's so much self-promotion. Maybe I'll take some more pictures of myself. So that's a book. Let me read you a little bit. And it was 10 minutes ago that I remembered We're a Mile Up, because I was feeling kind of funny, you know, but not usually. Often with altitude, I'll get a headache, but then someone will have mentioned You're a Mile Up. That is really high up. I mean, I'm not complaining, but I realized why I felt kind of funny. And then the way we found out was that I just couldn't get enough water. I was just swilling it down. When they said You're a Mile Up and it's really dry, and there's this terrible fire, you know, whose people experiencing it we pray for. So I'm very glad to be here. I love this bookstore. But I'm used to reading with Sam. We did this kind of duet. So I think I'll read a piece of mine and then a piece of his. And then I'm very happy to take questions about almost anything. Oh, okay. I want to tell you what's on the menu at my restaurant. At my hotel. Three different kinds of elk. Isn't that just so Sarah Palin? You can get elk breakfast sausage. You can get black bean and elk chili. And you can get, of course, the grilled elk. Isn't that a lot of elk to choose from? So, oops, wait. Yeah, that's the people that come to Colorado and pretended they, oh yeah, we ate some elk. I bagged an elk one night and outside of Denver. Yeah. Okay, this is called In the Beginning. This is me. My very young son became a father in mid-July 2009 when his girlfriend, Amy Tobias, gave birth to their son. They named him Jax Jesse Lamott. Jesse after Amy's beloved grandmother, Jessie, and Jax because they liked the way it sounded. Amy was 20 when she delivered and Sam was 19. They're both a little young. Don't worry about the baby. I'm very happy to hear baby sounds. I am. They're both a little young, but who asked me? Sam's birth on August 29th, 1989, was by far the most important day of my life, and Jax's was the second. Sam and I are quite close, and I'd always look forward with enthusiasm to becoming a grandmother someday in, say, 10 years from now. Perhaps after he had graduated from the art academy he attends in San Francisco and settled down into a career, and when I was old enough to be a grandmother. I was a young 55. Maybe a medium 55. Let's say a ripe 55 with a child just 1 year past his majority. You know, when they turn 18, they own themselves. It's awful. But it's true. And that's what you raise them to do. That's if you're not parents, if your nieces and nephews are turn 18, they belong to themselves. The day before Thanksgiving 2008, I had heard that Amy was expecting when I got a call from Sam in despair. "Mom, I'm going to be a father," he said. I was silent for a time. "Oh, Sam," I said finally. He and Amy had been together tumultuously since his birthday a year earlier, but they had split up a couple of months before, although not, I can see now, in the biblical sense. Amy is beautiful, tiny, and Hispanic. With her roots in Chicago and her parents now living in North Carolina, she had arrived in our lives on the morning of Sam's 18th birthday to attend cosmetology school in San Francisco. They had become friends at a camp on the East Coast, stayed in touch by phone and text, and begun a long-term relationship, which I hadn't heard about. One day, Sam told me he'd offered her his living room couch until she found an apartment. "Right," I said when he told me this plan. "I was not born yesterday." "God, Mom," he'd said. "Like, get your head out of the gutter." She had moved off the couch by lunch that first day. They arrived for Sam's family party at my house at 4 that afternoon, very much in love. My brother Steve-O, his sunny 6-year-old daughter Clara, and his fiance Annette were there, as was our beautiful uncle, our beloved Uncle Millard. Oh, I'm not going to read all the names, but they're all people you know from operating instructions. I live like a mile from where that book was written, and every single person from that book, unless they passed, is in this book too. I mean, it's funny. That was 20 years ago. Sam's 22. And I think I just feel very, very safe where I am and the people with whom I am. But you'll find, like Gertrude, who is my mother's best friend of 50 years, who is Sam's grandmother, my Uncle Millard, and a smattering of cousins. We were all transfixed by this beautiful girl who bounced into the house in tiny shorts that would fit my cat. She is around 4'9" and weighed 90 pounds at the time, with long black hair, huge brown eyes, and a perfect smile. And my first thought was, whom did I invite who has a teenage Hispanic daughter? I thought she might be related to Annette, my sister-in-law, who is also Latina. Then Sam stepped inside, smiling sheepishly, and introduced Amy to me. A little over a year later, Amy had terrible morning sickness that lasted a few months, and she spent a lot of time taking naps on my couch and nibbling bird-sized snacks. I was happy all the time at the thought of Sam's being a father and my getting to be a grandmother, except when I was sick with fears about their future and rage that they had gotten themselves pregnant so young or in a swivet of trying to control their every move, not to mention every aspect of their future. They moved into a one-room apartment a few blocks from the old studio where Sam had lived, and they created a nursery in a corner of the bedroom. Sam was woozy with pride and scared to death. Amy was clear, calm, and fiercely into becoming a mother. She did things the way she wanted to, even when it made me unhappy. Then it goes on, and how often I would just cry, because you think with your kid, if he or she doesn't do this, then this awful thing. If they did this, then there would be really good outcome for everyone. Right? Sam calls these Annie's good ideas. And there's a great line I've heard in recovery that says, "Don't inflict your goodness on everyone." But I want to. It's a thing. And I get so confused. Mostly the book is about, how do we let go? How do we stop thinking we're right? How do we understand what an intrusion it is to get in there and try to manage other people's lives? So, Sam tried to protect Amy from my neediness and anxieties, i.e. they purposely didn't call or text me for days, and they fought routinely. Amy would threaten to move back to Chicago, which made me crazier than anything, but I would not interfere, and Sam would call in despair, and I would stay neutral with undertones of suppressed rage. And they'd come through their conflict, and I would get to be the beloved tribal elder for having stayed impartial. So here's two little emails in a row from Sam. A lot of it was through email. Sometimes we would do an interview over the phone. A lot of it was not with intention. He would call and he'd say, I just realized something. Like, there's this one thing about how being a father changed his sense of what it means to have a heavenly father, you know, let alone an earthly father, and that he loves both. And to be a father gave him a sense of how deeply one is cherished. But he would start to talk, and I go, wait, let me get a pen, or the laptop, you know, let me get a laptop. Now it would be like, let me get my BlackBerry, you know, let me tweet this. August 3rd, email from Sam. Hi, Mom, here's the skinny on the fam. Jax's fingernails have gotten long again. We clipped them just last week. This is already one of our least favorite things to do. Since last night, he's managed to scratch his face a couple of times badly. A new development is that now when we pick him up, even if he is swaddled, he flails his arms in the air instead of lying passively in baby burrito mode. His hands now open and close, and because he is armed with claws, he scratches everything, including us. Between feedings last night, he was trying to stay awake with us, which was throwing off our schedule, because he needs to sleep, we need to rest, and then he needs to eat again, often, every few hours. It's like a perpetual motion machine. We loved it at the time last night because it was so cute to just look at him. Now, however, we are all wasted. I remember the first time I looked into his eyes 2 weeks ago. It felt like staring into a sky full of space, but the size of a marble, or into a deep, tiny ocean. We enjoyed our awake time with him until it caught up to us, and he was both exhausted and hungry at once. He wanted to eat, but was too tired to fully latch on, and was sobbing because it meant he couldn't get milk. And then this is the next day, August 4th. So Jax was born July 20th, so he's only a few weeks old. Amy is exhausted from Jax being fussy all night because of the frustrating sleeping, eating situation. I took Jax and let her sleep in, but she isn't pumping her breast milk, so I can't feed him. This made me sad and mad, not to sound too much like a Dr. Seuss book. I started thinking about how much I really hate the umbilical cord stump and wish I could pick it off. I'm fantasizing about how much easier life will be without it, bathing, being able to throw on diapers without worrying about it. This damn stump has been a nightmare for someone who worries and likes to control things because it has been spotty, bloody, and not at all cooperating with what I'd like to see there, which is a nice plain tummy. Bless you. But just as I was writing this now, Jax began to fuss. I walked over to pick him up, and as I did, this black thing rolls off him. I quickly realized it's the stump. I should be like, hooray, right? Nope. As I was going over to show off the new stomach situation to Amy, who had been peacefully sleeping, I looked down at where the stump was, and I was now convinced that I could see his insides. I don't think it healed right, and I'm looking at what must be his large intestine. I woke Amy up in a panic, yelling at her to call the paramedics. Jax needs surgery. Amy looks at what I'm seeing and is very concerned, but somehow keeps her cool and calls the pediatrician. During the phone call, I find blood on his fingernails. I've caught him red-handed. He has clawed open his stomach. Plus, it's all our fault because we didn't clip his nails. Amy called the pediatrician's office, and nobody seemed to be concerned that my baby's guts were coming out of his stomach. I mean, the person on the phone and then the advice nurse who listened to our concerns, there was no emotional change on their part. Are these people desensitized? When I'm convinced my child is dying, the medical professionals trying to sound calm actually have the opposite effect on me. So on the phone, I feel that this is a dire emergency and my baby probably needs emergency surgery. So these receptionists and nurses should be very attentive and concerned. Instead, they gently convince us that we didn't even need to come in, that Jax was perfectly fine. This small open wound turned out to be just a normal old gooey belly button. They see it every day. We covered it up with a SpongeBob SquarePants Band-Aid, and all is well-ish. So, thank you. So here we are at our podcast. Bless you. Do you want a Kleenex? We're at a podcast. Maybe I was only supposed to say it once. A podcast at Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, where it is a mile high. So I wonder if anybody has a few questions about... Usually, I mean, the obvious thing, I just already said it, is that people say, how is Sam? But Sam's good. You know, he's with Jax right now. I just talked to them both. And he's a very gifted design student. He took this last semester off, which was not my choice. And he and Amy are raising Jax together from separate counties, but very close together, one county apart. And... I see him 3 times a week. I see Jax. I talk to Sam's. He's just Sam. You know, they really come the way they are. It's so funny because you think you are just so influential and that you have a kid who's a little shy and watchful and doesn't read as early as the other kids. And then they grow up to be somebody who's sort of shy and very watchful and doesn't want to read as much as the other kids. And so... Let's see. Yeah. When I started, that's a very good question. When I started writing this book, did I know it was going to be about letting go of Sam? Well, by the time we started it, Amy, we knew she was pregnant at 1 month, and she was about 9.5 months pregnant when she delivered. And my control and obsession, and I know a lot of grandparents here are going, oh, God. Don't let her say it out loud, but it starts the second you find out that the woman is pregnant. And all I could do was to go to recovery meetings and talk about how I believe my ideas are good ideas. And I have good ideas for everyone. I have ideas for everyone here. I have ideas for your children. I have ideas for the people listening on the podcast, you know? And that it has been the greatest source of craziness in my life is that, A, I live in my head, and it's very hard for me to change channels down to my heart and my breath. And And B, that it's just hard for, it's just hard to let go of young people who are unspeakably precious to you, whether they're your kids, your grandkids, and your nieces or nephews. And it's hard, and because it's a dangerous world. And it was dangerous in the 20s when there were no antibiotics. And it was 20 when there were saber-toothed tigers. It's just a scary, strange place. I always say it has not been a good match for me, you know, because I'm so sensitive, and Sam is too, and he hates it, and his father's sensitive. So he says in the book, I got like the double whammy. They're both this way that I hate most of all. But I sort of had an inkling that my tiny, tiny control issues were not going to improve once the baby arrived. But, you know, the stuff I've written about, 32 years since Hard Laughter, it's the 13th book, and they've all been about the same thing. It's about how families save us and drive us crazy. It's about how two or three or four good friends is the difference between life and psychic death here. That if you want to let go, tell someone. That the secret of letting go is to call, pick up the 500-pound phone and say to someone, do you have a minute? Because as soon as you start talking, you probably get your sense of humor back. And the person on the other end, if he or she's one of these two or three people, will say, you know what, me too. And they'll say, you know what, we're all in the same boat. And I think this is useful. In my experience, this isn't. So it's all the same themes. And so I actually didn't know what it was going to be like as a piece of work. But I hoped it would be unlike anything ever written, including operating instructions. And that hope is what was my driving force. So there's like 20 pages on a trip to India I took when Jax was about 6 months old. I went to the Baltic nations. I went to a concentration camp. I was on book tour. I was probably here in Denver. I don't remember what I wrote about. But, you know, you write 25 pages about your book tour, and people are going to want to read about three. So with everything comes out way too long, and nothing comes out well written. And that was true for Sam, and that was true for me. So that's really how it got written, was kind of trying to let it tell us, show us what we could include, which you can, in your work, I want to tell you, you can include anything you can get away with. Because most people say, well, I don't really see that a 10-day trip to India fits into a baby book so much. But of course it does if it is a good fit. If it's there because it was in the natural order of things, and it was, so, yeah. In the back, in the very back, yeah, you, in front of the person in green, yeah. How much time as a parent and a famous author do I spend journaling every day? None. Zero. I never journal unless I'm doing a book as a journal. I did a journal by accident with operating instructions. It's not my form. Sam loves it, and he does it every day. It's not my style. What I do is I take notes. You know, I always have pens. I always have paper, unless I've just announced that I always have paper. But the thing is that I do is I sit down and get my work done 5 days a week. So that is, for me, a sacred honor. That's a debt I've made to myself. So I never feel like writing. And if anything at all is happening, like the Supreme Court or the election, I mean, I just have to say I love every single one of the Republican candidates more than the last one. I love them, love them, love them. They've given me life. And but when I'm writing, I want to go watch MSNBC. You know, it's hard for me to write. I don't have probably too much more self-esteem than you do. We're all in the same boat. I have a big ego, and I have really shaky self-esteem. And the way you wear both of those things out, and just the ticker tape of thoughts and things you should have done before you sat down, the things that you've meant to do for so long, the thing that, oh my God, what you just remembered is in the back seat that you have to bring in, or this or that. I just grind it down by keeping my butt in the chair. And I try to write for 3 hours. I sit down at the same time every day. I don't ever say to myself the night before, "What at approximately what time do you think you might want to write tomorrow?" Ever. So if you have kids, if you have a full-time job, if you have a sick parent, if you have anything that you're using as the reason you're not writing, I am so on to you. Because if you want to write, write. And if Sam was here, he does this wonderful thing because he doesn't know what he's doing, but he knows he's not defeated, and he doesn't want to wake up someday and be an old guy who's just full of regrets. And that guides him. So I just do it. Yes, in the red.
This isn't actually a question.
Okay.
You just said that.
Okay.
I teach introductory creative writing at one of the colleges here. Mm-hmm. And I always make have my students comments on the chapters they've read.
Uh-huh.
And every single semester, and I've been teaching a book for 16 years, 15 years, something like that, they get enormous solace from the fact that you're a published author,
yeah.
Still struggle
with
all that. Yeah. It really gives them a lot of inspiration and hope.
Good.
It's okay that they feel the same way.
Well, for the podcast people, what she was saying was she's been a teacher for 16 years at a college in this area of Denver, and it really gives her students hope that I so struggle. And I think with all of my books, especially Operating Instructions, Bird by Bird, and the books on faith, that's what I have to offer, is that it's been the same with being, you know, when I had Sam, my one claim to fame is there weren't books where people said, "I feel very crazy. I have a colicky infant and I feel very crazy and I actually don't like children," you know, but when I talked to other mothers and fathers, and I had this one thing that I sort of my favorite thing in Operating Instructions, where I had this idea after about 2 weeks of colic that I would wrap him up, bundle him up, and leave him outside for just one night, and so I could get a little sleep so I didn't have a nervous breakdown. And if I mentioned that to parents, everyone said, "Oh my God, me too, me too." And which is the basis of my entire faith walk, is people will say, "Me too." Jesus would have said, "Me too." He would have had a terrible time with an infant. Terrible. Terrible. They're really hard. They're the hardest thing you're ever going to do, except for probably writing. Right up there with writing. When I wrote Bird by Bird, almost all the existing writing books said if you did certain things would surely happen. You would build up a habit of confidence, and then what you would do at some point was to find an agent. And it was such a crock. But I've been teaching writing, too. I had been for a very long time, and what I knew was that if people wrote, they would feel really differently by the end of the day. At the end of every day that they wrote, they were going to feel different, and that they were going to know themselves, and that it was going to give them the single most precious thing that they could get, which was their own selves, their own motley selves. And yet all of us, including me, think it's out there, and think that if you get the right review, if you get the right ranking, if you get the right Amazon sales rank, if you get a big enough crowd, you know what, this is so wonderful for me, and it will make me happy all night, but then it'll be gone. I know you won't all be there tonight eating elk with me, and I know your type, and then I'm going to just be exactly who you are, which is just one human being trying to have some integrity, trying not to be overwhelmed with fear and anxiety, trying to keep my head above water and keep my sense of humor, and some days go better than others. So with writing, I thought, God, if I could just tell people how great it is to develop that habit. It's just a habit that you do it. You do it badly. Maybe you're going to find a couple other people, and you're going to somehow kind of keep each other on the screen. You're going to meet at the Tatter bookstore or wherever you live and every 2 weeks, and you're going to give each other material. You're going to bring it to class. It's going to get read, and people are going to critique it. You're going to find a couple other people who get you in that sense of, I just get it. And they get you, and you get them. And then you're home free, because that's what we're all so hungry for. Yes, in the turquoise. What's it like for me to witness Sam writing as well as he does? Well, mostly it was about him handing me stuff or emailing me stuff. And You know, the whole thing of mentoring a young person is just so touching. I really think it's one of the sacred honors, sacred roles that the ever so slightly older people have the opportunity to take on, whether it's in a community, whether it's a mentoring or tutoring, or whether it's with your own kid. So with Sam, you know, he so has me wrapped around his little finger. And he would always, and I know your students do too, they all have just so many reasons why it's not going to happen. And or why it's like you're the problem with your incessant nagging and deadlines. And you got to say to him, you know, no one cares if you write. I can write this book by myself. No one cares if you write. So you have to. And if you care, do it, because you don't want to be an old guy with regrets. How about being a 21-year-old with regrets who didn't get around to chronicling the most precious and trippy and funny and hard memories of his son's first year? So the thing was, I would just get into kind of a mood, you know, because I'm so good. I have the habit. I get my work done. And so I get into a mood, and he was a teenager. You know, he's still a teenager. He's 22. You don't get your neocortex isn't fully developed till you're like 25. And boy, I can attest to that. But I mean that in a warm, loving Christian way. But they're really still teenagers. But then what would happen is he would get me the material, and I know it's exactly the same for you too, and it would just blow me away. And I go, wow. So that's what it was like. It was like real life. It was wonderful. It was frustrating. It was hard work. It was funny. Yeah, in the front.
Did you find a real shift in how you felt as a parent to Sam when Jax was born? In that watching your own children grow up and go through all these trials and tribulations as well.
Mm-hmm.
Watching
them, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. And just, you know, and watching them just be a wonderful parent.
A wonderful parent who screws up, like the rest of us, right? The question was for the podcast people, what was it like, having been a parent, watch myself parent Sam, to watch Sam parent Jackson, to watch myself grandparent a child, which, you know, how are you supposed to know what you're doing? How are you supposed to know how to parent? I had a mother who got very sick with Alzheimer's, but she was kind of okay for a couple years, and we asked for help. I mean, that's like rule one, is seek wise counsel. Other people know what might help because they've been there. But I remember with my mom, we called an Alzheimer's nurse, an elder care nurse, and I have two brothers, and we had them come over and spend some time with mom, and then we got together with her, and we said, and she also had diabetes, she was overweight, and she was this kind of stealth eater. We said, we don't know what this means, we don't know when to start doing that, we don't know if this is helpful or if it infantilizes her, and we just went on and on, because you're at the end of your rope, right? And the nurse was elderly, said, how could you know? And you know what? That hadn't occurred to me. The three of us just thought we were like too narcissistic or too impatient with her or too this or too that. How could you know? So what it was like watching Sam parent Jax and watching me parent Sam was how could I know what to expect? And everybody just is very disappointing. I was very disappointing parenting Sam, and Sam was very disappointing parenting Jax, and I would get very impatient with him. And then I would get so mad and afraid at how impatient I was about Sam, because I thought he wasn't doing the right thing with Jax. And so you always have the choice. You can do that loop of watching that play out, which is sort of like your entire childhood, or you can change channels and you can start to watch the amazement that a number of times your son did notice that the baby needed a clean diaper. And he says in here, sometimes he would wait for Amy to discover it because, you know, and then he said, I don't want to swear because there are a couple little ones around, but that was total BS, you know, to do that, to wait for the mom to find out. And so I would watch him notice and that, you know, it's not like the lights go on and you get to run in slow motion through, you know, across the sands. It's like little, it's bird by bird. It's mosaic chips that you get familiar with that maybe have crashed to the floor and you pick them up and you feel and you see where the other similar colors are and where it might go. And all I can say is that some days go better than others. So one more question. Yeah. Yeah. Yes. Yes.
I heard your interview with Kelly
Corrigan. Oh, yeah. Oh, I want to tell everyone about that. Yeah. Another thing I want to tell everyone about. Yeah. Thank you. Oh, you did? Okay, thank you. I didn't do that. I can't do that. But other people helped me do that, yeah. Anyway, there's an interview with Kelly Corrigan on Facebook, or YouTube. If you can watch it on YouTube, or you can go to my Facebook. But if you go to YouTube, and you know the great Kelly Corrigan, I just have to preface it, she wrote The Middle Place, and she's brilliant and funny and committed to the common good. She's doing a very important work with Children's Hospital in Oakland. So we did a sort of fundraiser, and we did an interview. It's about half an hour, and she took the clip on mothers-in-law. But I haven't actually looked at it because I don't like to see myself. I can't, you know, I don't like, love to listen to myself or even like to. But I heard it's really charming. But she's wonderful. When you see her, you're going to like me, her more than you like me. You really are, because she's young and she's been through terrible breast cancer. She's so funny because she's so positive and so dark. And she's just like a perfect person to be interviewed by. But go ahead, hon. Okay, that's a great place to end, and then it's perfect timing. In this interview, well, first of all, I said my very, very favorite acronym, which is, because she was asking for advice or for me to say stuff that maybe her mother-in-law would hear and pick up on. And the acronym I offered was WAIT, which is, why am I talking? And nothing has been more valuable working with young people, Sam and Amy, and than to just keep saying to myself, Annie, why are you talking? They don't care. They're not listening. They're mad. They think you're old and that you're getting funny. And yet you are trying to convince them that you have interesting thoughts on this subject. So I said in this interview, the most important thing, I'll be 58 in 10 days or so, April 10th, so a little bit more than that. The thing I have had to fight for hardest my whole life was to fall in love with me, because I was raised around people whose marriage was so terrible. And as a little child, I believed that if I did a little bit better or had fewer needs or took the pressure off of mom and dad by raising both of my brothers, that they would be okay and they would be more affectionate with each other. And then there'd be this Reaganomic trickle down, right? So I had to learn that I was the one I was looking for, that I was the one whose respect I was craving, that I had this addiction to people-pleasing, and what I had to do with it was the separation from self. So I learned from other mothers. I actually have a third piece, but it's not out till May, but it's, if you won't, well, first of all, you won't believe this, it's in Good Housekeeping. Thank you. But it's called The Other Mothers, and it's about the role that the other mothers who got us played in shaping us and helping us come to discover that we were actually beautiful and that we were, that B pluses were a good grade, which I was 35 when I discovered. But so the other mothers taught you how, what deep value, that you were delightful. But parents often don't have that opportunity because they have their hands full. They've got other kids. There's all this homework due. There's the schedule. There's the shopping. And so I grew up not knowing that I was delightful, just not achieving at all, just being, just like being a kid on a bookstore floor, you know. And so when the women's movement happened in 1970 and the first issue of Ms. came out, or 69, that was when my life began. And that was when I began to understand that it wasn't the powerful men whose love and respect I needed, that it was my own. and that I could spend my entire life trying to compete with the powerful and sometimes very angry and sometimes scary men because I was great with men, or I could begin this work of learning, unlearning. And so to be militant, it's like I'm militant about my work. I just do it. And I'm militant, and I practice what I call radical self-care. And that means, like, before I came here, I was really hungry, and, you know, all there was on the menu was elk and buffalo. And, no, I mean, there's actually kind of, it wasn't a great menu, and I had to be like a mother with myself, because then I thought, well, don't eat. Okay, we won't eat. Okay, wait, we'll do this. You can eat later. Well, you already ate. You ate it, too. You can't be hungry again. But someone else's mother would go, I don't see why you wouldn't be hungry again. You ate it, too. That was a while ago. And then I had to, like a mother, go, well, are you in the mood for something crunchy? Or are you in the mood for something creamy? Do you want to have an apple tart? Or do you want to have fish tacos, which is what I ended up having. But it was the most important skill I've learned, is to be the mother to my own true self. Thank you.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.